Welcome to the Inside the Boards podcast, the podcast dedicated to helping you learn to think like a question writer so you can study smarter, not harder, and succeed in medical school.
All right, welcome to the Inside the Boards podcast. Today, I am joined by Mariah Siddiqui, who is one of the new ITB hosts at large, because this is a bigger project than Patrick Beeman can do alone. So we've invited a number of motivated people like Mariah to join us in helping, you know, teach med students how to think like question writers and fulfill that part of the Hippocratic Oath, which is to freely teach this art, namely of medicine. So Mariah, welcome, and thank you for helping ITB. I really can't express enough how anytime somebody's like, I'll edit a question, I'll send an email for you, it means a lot, for real.
No problem. And honestly, like, thank you so much for letting me be a part of this community to help medical students and doctors everywhere, because podcasts are so, so helpful to students, especially when we're trying to study, but we can't, you know, read, or we can't sit down and study. They're so useful to have. So thank you for actually starting this podcast, Patrick.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's been fun. And, you know, on that note, if anyone else wants to get involved in ITB podcasting to their fellow med students, info@insidetheboards.com. Always looking for people to help us do these sorts of like series, and especially come like February through June-ish, when step one comes around during our step one Study Smarter series. That's, you know, even though step one is going to be pass fail now, still super helpful if you can study on the go and save some time, which ultimately is ITB's, you know, kind of purpose, to give you back some of your lives, that medicine has stole from you. No, I'm just kidding. Well, I'm sort of kidding, sort of not kidding. So many things to complain about. But let's not think about those, because actually we're recording this the day before Thanksgiving 2020. So let's be thankful for medicine, for this profession, and for the people who are willing to help us fulfill our goals of helping others, which you will find out, if you haven't already, that being a doctor is very often about knowing how to enlist the help of others to help this other person. Like, you know, simple example, hey, where's the bathroom? When you're walking in the hospital, someone grabs me and says that, like, oh, I have no idea. You know, like, I half the time I go to this one bathroom, that's the one I use. Or the phone rings on the L&D desk, and it's like all this anxiety, like, oh God, I don't know what to do. I can answer it, but I can't send the call anywhere. I don't know how to do that. You need others to help others. But all right, I'm rambling. Mariah, tell us about yourself. What year of school are you?
So I'm a third year medical student at St. George's University in Grenada.
Cool.
Yeah, so I'm actually doing my rotations right now in New York. And just a little bit about myself. I like traveling. I like to be in the outdoors. I like computer games.
Like what?
Like, I play some League of Legends sometimes with my friends. I'm not like the best at it, but it's a lot of fun still. And yeah, I'm just trying to like study. I have shelf exams coming up, two whole years of rotations to do. So just find, you know, I'm trying to find a balance of studying and having a good time, I guess.
Yeah, balance, right?
Yeah.
I mean, look, I have not made as many episodes lately, and yes, a lot of it is because like I opened a clinic, still doing OB hospitalist stuff, kids, like, plus like a shit ton of other things I just, you know, can't get into. But also partly because I got an Oculus Quest. Holy crap. I mean, that thing is crazy. It's like the experience you had, probably a lot of us, when the iPhone came out and you like got an iPhone, you're just like, what?
So it's fascinating. A phone, yes.
And a camera. and you can play games on it and like a whole bunch of other things. So the Oculus is a true game changer. So I'm not sponsored by Facebook saying this. I wish we were, quite frankly. Then we could pay people like Mariah to help. but yeah, it's pretty sweet. So if you ever get an Oculus, they'll be within the price range of many of us who even aren't attendings. But I don't even probably should say that because it sounds totally like, yeah, he should talk. He doesn't subsist on loans, which is true. It took a while to get there. All right, League of Legends, you play that. You like to be outdoors. And what podcasts do you like? What's your favorite non-medical podcast?
I actually listen to audiobooks more than podcasts. Well, I like podcasts that are medical.
Past one or two then. Past two audiobooks.
Past one was The Alchemist. I read it many times, but I also like to listen to it again. And the one before that, I forgot the name of it, but it was like very cliche, how to be like a more positive person and like how to take life in a more positive way. And just to...
You a pessimist?
No, I think like it's more about how to... I'm actually like very optimistic, but it's more about how to like deal with your own problems in like a healthy way. It's just like a very cliche, like self-help kind of book. But it was just on my like list of books, so I would just listen to it sometimes.
It's helpful though, like a lot of that sort of self-help stuff. Yeah. One of the things I've sort of realized since I've been doing like this outpatient opioid use disorder treatment is for people who actually need to help themselves. Like that's not everyone. Like I talk to patients with opiate use disorders all the time now, and you just get the sense, and usually they do too, by the time they're like coming to ask for medication assisted treatment, you just realize like the people who have their lives quote together versus those who don't, they kind of follow even like that 12-step program, just like without being conscious of it. You know, like when they're struggling with something, or they have a problem, they have the insight, self-awareness, they know themselves enough to recognize it and say, I have a problem. A lot of them don't see themselves as the center of the world or even their world. So I think the second step is, you know, giving yourself up to a higher power or recognizing that your life has become unmanageable. Yeah. And then I think it's giving yourself up to a higher power. I definitely know that one's in there though. But there's 12 steps and I just don't memorize lists anymore because I don't have to. I'm not in med school. No, just kidding. But yeah, I wouldn't, you know, don't knock the fact that you're listening to that. I can think of a lot of books that I've read, especially since I started doing the ITB stuff in 2016 or 15, about personality theory, psychology, a lot of it popular psychology, business type books or these motivational type books, as it were. But a lot of it's good. And a lot of it can help provide a framework for your life, a plan for your life, at least give you something. So figure out which one that is and let me know. Maybe I'll listen to it.
I will.
All right. Medical podcast then. What do you listen to besides like ITB stuff?
I also like Curbsiders. I love their internal medicine series.
Is it good for boards prep?
Parts of it I think are. Like some of the stuff is more like article based and kind of controversial stuff, but a lot of it is board prep, just like basic medical knowledge that is useful to know when you're rotating or during, you know, internal medicine. Rounds or anything internal medicine related. So I really like that they use cases, that they use articles, because it helps to solidify like my own knowledge. Because if it's just like some like repeating facts, or if it's just, you know, content, it doesn't always stick as much. But if there's like a case that I can link something back to, it helps me a lot more. So I like listening to their podcasts.
Cool. I can think of a few that are getting popular that I don't want to mention. No, I'm just kidding. I will say one thing I feel obligated to tell the listeners, even though, of course, please, yes, continue to listen to Inside the Boards, but the Divine Intervention podcast with Divine, I forget his last name, but it's pretty good. It's pretty good. He does some excellent work, like breaking down concepts. And despite how many emails, Reddit messages, times I've filled out the form on his website, and comments I've made on YouTube videos, he won't get back to me. So any of you who are listening to Divine and maybe doing one of his reviews, tell him to contact us or respond to one of my emails, because I know we could work together for the good of all of you. And maybe I'm coming off too strong, but I don't give up. I just keep sending emails till someone replies. All right, so what do you think you want to go into?
I'm not 100% sure yet, because I haven't done all my rotations yet.
Smart.
I do enjoy internal medicine. I also feel like neuro is something I'm interested in, because I personally, like, I get migraines. So today's like topic is also going to be about headaches. So that's why I feel like that would be a good specialty for me. But I'm honestly, like, I'm still clueless right now as to what I want to do.
That's okay.
How did you know that you wanted to go into your specialty?
Well, number one, I liked everything pretty much during third year, which is, I think, the best position to be in. I went into med school with the mindset that I'd probably do like surgery, because surgery is so cool. And it is. I've enjoyed doing surgery, the parts that I do over these years. But my background was in philosophy, so I also knew I wanted to do something related to ethics, bioethics. And with that in mind, I try to do too many things for sure. And I especially love when I can consolidate goals and, you know, you have overlapping things. So like dual degrees, oh man, what a great idea as an example. But I kept thinking about my overall goals, looking towards the future. What did I want my life to look like? And how I wanted my life to look was based on one of the biggest influences that I had in becoming a doctor, which is the late Dr. Edmund Pellegrino, who has been called the father of bioethics. He was a huge proponent of medical humanities. I was his fellow during my second year of med school at Georgetown. Over the summer. And he wrote 600 articles. He was the president of a university at one point. He had dual appointments in the departments of philosophy and medicine at Georgetown. So to me, that would have been like the ultimate thing. Like, oh my gosh, I'd be a professor in two different departments, doing bioethics and also practicing medicine. When I got to the end of third year, done all the rotations, I was like, surgery, nope, not doing it. Got depressed for legit the first time during October of 2008, when I was a third year. And I was like, yeah, probably not going to do that because these are not my people, and ruled out other things like peds. Peds didn't strike me. It just didn't capture me. I mean, yes, absolutely, things were interesting, but it didn't really like pull me in. What else? Ruled out family, probably in large part because the clinic that I shadowed was like super busy, and that is not what I thought being a doctor would be like. And it's so hard to develop relationships with people now, which is what a lot of us, probably what we think about going into medicine, and probably what we ought to be doing as we interact with patients, building, you know, healthy relationships. I whittled it down to OBGYN because there's a crap ton of bioethics issues. So there would have been a lot of opportunities for, you know, research publication. And frankly, in a world where people are so polarized and can't talk to one another, there really isn't, I think there's a couple, but there's very few people who have the medical expertise and the expertise in bioethics to be able to, you know, shepherd people through, difficult moral quandaries. So that really attracted me, a lot of material potentially there. And then psychiatry, I just liked, also a lot of ethical issues in psychiatry, which was attractive. But when it came down to it, I didn't really want to leave the OR. I liked physical examination. And so I didn't really want to leave that either at the time. And if you've listened to this podcast, you know, I've probably definitely changed my outlook. At the time, I think too, there was this, psychiatry is like not really a, you know, it's not like being a real doctor. And I know that probably still exists out there, which is ridiculous. Honestly, now I kind of see psychiatry as like the ultimate doctor because, I mean, it literally means like physician of the mind or soul. The stigma, I guess, maybe I was prideful. Maybe I thought, nah, I'm not going to do it because it's not prestigious. I don't know. Because looking back, I probably should have done psychiatry knowing my ultimate goals in just the fact that I can't just do one thing. And if you do a specialty like general surgery, neurosurgery, OBGYN to a large extent, you got to be all about that and nothing else because it just takes so much time to do it well. So I don't know. I rambled a lot, but I honestly, I don't know. It's just how it worked out. I know it was a week before I ranked that I was still torn. All my friends were like, dude, don't do OBGYN. And if you're a male who's been on an OBGYN rotation recently too, you will know that it can be a very awkward experience. People kind of look at you askew, like, oh, why is that person doing that? And granted, there are a lot of creepers. There are a lot of creepers out there. But the challenge of doing obstetrics, there's so much like awesome stuff about it. And I think a lot of people don't realize medical training pretty much, you know, clinifies you. You just get so clinical about so many things that the normal people out there who have not been hurt by medical education or changed by medical education, transformed their way of seeing the world, they just don't get. Still, my friends they ragged on me, you know, they're like, don't do OBGYN, and then made inappropriate jokes, which I won't repeat, and which everyone out there, if you are an OBGYN, don't ever make an inappropriate joke. There is no place for it, and it is a surefire way for you to like start down the path of being a creeper. So
yeah.
little extra professionalism goes a long way when you're dealing with super sensitive things. And there's tons of applicability to that. Like, don't ever let yourself say something negative about a patient who has an addiction, who comes in and is, quote, like trying to game the system to get high. That's a very simplistic way of looking at it. You know, don't get annoyed by the little old ladies, you know?
Yeah. I feel like we have to separate our immature selves from our professional selves sometimes.
Let me ask you, do you think that the whole way we do medical education nowadays, does that prevent people, you know, with their age matched peers from being mature, from maturing enough?
That's a good question. I feel like, honestly, it depends. There are some really young people who are very mature, and there are some very, like, some older people who aren't as mature. I feel like it really just depends person by person. In terms of medical education, I honestly don't think that, I don't think there's like any way to really change much of how we're getting taught to make people more professional, because I know they really, really hammer that into us in school to be professional, to make sure that we don't, you know, make jokes or do any sort of inappropriate stuff in the hospital, outside the hospital, on social media or anywhere. So I feel like honestly it just depends on who the people are. Is that your question? Sorry.
Yeah, pretty much. And you know, even about that subject, Pellegrino wrote a number of books and articles, like 600 articles, I think like 20 books. And a lot of them deal with the concept of a profession. Like, ours is not like a job. If you're thinking of it like a job, you're wrong. Ours is a profession where there is an inequality that exists inherently within the relationship. The doctor has all the knowledge, all the power, if you will, in meeting somebody who comes to them requesting help. You know, I profess as part of this moral community of medicine to be a healer. And then people, you know, look upon that and come to me with these expectations. So professionalism, it seems to me, has kind of devolved in its conceptualization into a checklist of things like, if you have piercing on your nose, you take that out, or don't let a tattoo show, you know, be on time, make sure your shit is ironed. I don't know, you know, things of this nature. And that is all, there are aspects of that, but really professionalism is, it springs from being a virtuous, a good person, I think. And it's hard to teach that. Like, can virtue be taught? You know, people have been asking that since Plato, which the dialogue, the Meno, if you're interested in exploring that further. But yeah, professionalism, like, what is professionalism? Because I have a bunch of tattoos, but I did not get a tattoo until I was a second year resident. And I will tell you now, absolutely now, I will defend having a bunch of visible tattoos, because with my patients, it's like instant rapport. You know, they just think I'm legit because I like to think because I am, but you know, I'm trying to meet that. Maybe I'm just playing a part. Maybe it's somewhat of an act from who I am outside of the clinic. And it probably is to a certain extent. It needs to be, because, you know, you'll get terrible news. Trust me, at some point you'll get terrible personal news that really hurts, or you'll be going through something really tough in your personal life. But when you knock on that door, because you're always going to knock first, that is part of being professional, but more so respecting privacy. From the time you knock on that door to the time you leave, you are playing a part. You are, you know, being that, you know, professional, and you have to act, and you do it for the good of the patient. So that's not to say everybody should get a visible tattoo. Definitely, if you're on rotation or in any context, keep that shit covered. Initially. And then when you've won people over with your winsome personality, then you can be a little more relaxed.
Yeah, I agree that a lot of it's your character. And I'm really glad that you got your tattoo. Then you can like express yourself through, you know, through that. And people with their, you know, there's people who like to dye their hair or do their nails and like tattoos in your case. And I feel like there's a lot of like stigma attached to things like that, but I'm glad that you're starting to kind of help break out of that, like, I don't know the word I'm looking for.
Mold?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, also I will grant you all, like, full disclosure, like, Nick Nissen, who's part of our platform, he's one of my partners in this whole endeavor. First year resident in psychiatry at Harvard. I remember we had this conversation once. He was like, look, you admit, like, you're like kind of a weird, or you're a different kind of person, right? And I was like, or you're different. And I was like, yeah, that's true. So, you know, you have to take yourself with a grain of salt and truly as well. So maybe I'm totally wrong. I don't know.
Just embrace it. Embrace everything it, that you yeah. are.
Don't do anything illegal or, you know, wrong. But aside from that, like, you know, be the best you can be. Like, enjoy your life. Set it up. Don't take any crap from anyone. Like, as much as you can, value time over money. When you negotiate contracts in when you're becoming an attendings, like think about what truly is important. And for a lot of people, that's going to be time because you can't get that back.
Exactly. Like, I think it's very important to be around positivity, good vibes, like good people. So I really agree with that statement. But now I can ask you the question that I have written out.
Oh, yeah. I guess we should get into that. Yeah. Turn the tables. I'll be the student.
Okay. So I'll be the new host.
Okay.
The question is, a 31-year-old woman comes to her physician due to numerous headaches in the past 6 months. She states that her headaches last 5 to 6 hours and are unilateral and throbbing in nature. Her headaches are sometimes accompanied by nausea, and she says she needs to lay in a dark room until they subside. Ibuprofen helps her headaches, and doing any physical activity makes them worse. She states that her headaches have increased in intensity in the last month, and she's been having them 4 to 5 times a week. Her vitals are unremarkable. Which of the following therapies is the most appropriate in the long-term management of this patient? Is it A, ergotamine, B, propranolol, C, sumatriptan, or D, naproxen? So what do you think, Patrick, when you see this question?
Yeah, which of the following therapies is most appropriate in the long-term management of this patient? So a couple things. She's already taken ibuprofen, right? So I'm going to not immediately rule that out, but because it's the same medication class, it's probably not going to be the right answer. So less impressed with that one. Ergotamine, so ergot alkaloids, I believe they're first line for abortive medications. Yours, sumatriptan, right? Are those the ergot based drugs, or is ergotamine? I can't even remember.
Ergotamine is the, I guess it's like that's its own drug, and then sumatriptan is in a different category of drugs.
Oh, it is?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. See, don't even remember that. So, I would have ruled that one out though, because I take it to be an abortive medication, whether or not that's true.
Mm-hmm.
Sumatriptan. Oh, I didn't even see that. That was an answer. I wasn't paying attention. Sumatriptan is, I know, first line for abortive treatment of a migraine. And then propranolol is going to be your prophylactic medication. So to me, long-term management, I would go with propranolol.
Yes, you are correct. So
okay, good.
Awesome job. And I like the way that you talked it out, because everything you said was like spot on. So propranolol is a beta blocker. It's normally one of the first line drugs that's used in long-term prophylaxis for migraines. So how did you figure out that she was having a migraine at all, like as opposed to maybe a different type of headache, like a cluster headache or a tension headache?
Well, I mean, the way I would do it is based on the features in the vignette. So, and because you see these pretty commonly, and also the answer choices are very geared towards migraine. So I remember that portion of things. So I look through, it's a 31-year-old lady. She's got a bunch of headaches over the past 6 months. They last for hours. They're unilateral and throbbing, which unilaterality and the throbbing nature character of the pain is quintessential of migraineurs, which is a great term.
Yeah.
The accompaniment with nausea, improvement or photo in the dark or having photophobia, all these things just kind of have me focused on that as the go-to answer. And I would expect a different characterization of pain with the other headache syndromes you mentioned. So I didn't even really think about it at this point, to be honest.
But you got like everything right. So everything you said was correct, like the nature of the pain, the throbbing unilateral pain, as opposed to something like a tension headache, which would be more bilateral. It's like called band-like pain, and a cluster headache is normally associated with pain behind the eye, or, you know, there's also like rhinorrhea, lacrimation, and some other symptoms. But with migraines specifically, there's the nausea. They can present with an aura. So there's two types of migraines. Normally there's migraine with aura, migraine without aura. And an aura is just like some symptoms that occur before the migraine happens. It could be hearing things, seeing things, having like a change in vision. And that's something that people that's when people normally realize that they're about to have a migraine. So, but a lot of people also have migraines without auras. So, overall, like, migraines are very common. About like 15 to 17% of females get them. So it is more female dominant, and about 5 to 6% of males get them. The exact like pathophys is unclear. It's something that they haven't figured out exactly the cause.
Well, that's good, because there probably won't be questions on that.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's good, but it like sucks for people like me who have migraines and can't ever find anything to get rid of them. But they think there's like some association with the trigeminal vascular system. There's some peptides involved, like CGRP and some other like hormones. So that's kind of what they also aim when they're thinking about that's what they aim at when they're thinking about treatment. We talked about the aura, the headache itself. It could be from 4 to like 24 hours, and sometimes even like two or three days, which is pretty crazy. And a lot of times people have like photophobia, and nausea and vomiting. So there are some triggers for migraines, like different foods, smells. It could be loud noises, or like even things like coffee. And there was like a study that was actually done. It was talked about in an article that was published in November in the New England Journal of Medicine, that did like a study that showed that triggers, like, they tested a group of people to see if their trigger was actually a trigger for their migraines or their like presumed trigger. But they found that, like, I think only 3 out of like 20-something people ended up having a headache after their trigger was like exposed to them. So I don't know about the whole trigger thing, but I do know like certain people do have a lot of triggers. I still don't know what my trigger is. So
what about the pounding mnemonic? Because I also think about that, or pound mnemonic.
Yeah, there is. It's the pound. I remember it.
Pulsatile. O, whatever O is. Unilateral. Nausea. Disabling. So those are kind of the clinical features to help you remember. But what is the O?
So it's pulsatile. O is for the hours of duration, I guess, for 72 hours. The unilateral.
Oh, like 1 day.
Yeah.
1 day. That's what it is. 1 day.
Oh, 1 day. Okay. Okay. So the O is for 1 day, unilateral nausea, and the D is for disabling, I think.
Yeah.
Because it's like very, very debilitating. It's.
Which that brings up a good point too. It took me a while to realize that in common parlance amongst patients, people will report a history of migraine, right? I have migraines all the time. And for, you know, the students out there, if you're not used to this, a lot of times they just mean I have bad headaches or frequent headaches. Like, oh, I have a migraine. You're thinking, oh, you got to take like an abortifacient medication right now. Or an abortive medicine right now. Take your triptan. But like, I have migraines. And then they tell you it feels like a band squeezing my head constantly on both sides. Nah, I'm not really nauseated or anything. I don't really want to move my head. Is it pulsatile? No, and they like don't have classic migraine features. They're just saying migraine. So migraine can mean just bad headache to patients a lot of times, like pap smear can mean pelvic exam. That took me a while to figure out too, because I'd be like, what? No, you don't need a pap smear every year. That's weird. But patients often just don't realize that the, you know, Papanicolaus smear is literally a specific type of cell collection. Pearl, little clinical pearl.
Yeah, I don't know about the pap smear thing. That's pretty crazy, actually.
Yeah, you'll definitely encounter that. And, you know, sometimes it makes a difference. Like somebody says they have migraine, and you don't investigate that further, it might change what you give them as far as therapy goes. Hopefully not. Hopefully you're on your toes and learning to think clinically, which often involves too understanding what the patient is saying and the fact that they might not use the same language in a fashion that you are. There can be some equivocation there.
Exactly. Like, I feel like a lot of people use the word headache and migraine interchangeably, which, yeah, like, which is totally understandable, but I feel like migraines are very specific in their own way. So,
you know what I've found? Oh, you have a history of migraine? Have you seen a neurologist before? If they say yes, then they probably have actual migraine headaches, like they have a migraine syndrome. If they haven't, then, you know, it's not as helpful, but it's pretty, I would say, specific. You can rule it in if somebody has seen a neurologist, so.
Exactly. And like you said, you have to be on your toes, because sometimes these patients, for them, let's say like they don't have a migraine and it might be a mass or, you know, a tumor of some sort. That's something that we always have to rule out as well. So it's really, really important to get the entire history from the patient to figure out, is this new onset? You know, did you have any trauma or injury? Because, you know, you don't want to miss a brain tumor. So, and they do cause headaches similar to migraines, actually. So, but then there's like different types of migraines. There's chronic migraines, which are migraines that happen more than 15 times in a month. And then for those, like, they have some different treatment options as well. But just to quickly talk about treatments, like you mentioned before, like the ablative therapy, that would be things like...
Well, I guess first line actually probably would be Tylenol or an NSAID.
Yeah.
Because actually, if I recall, you give like 800 milligrams of ibuprofen 3 times a day, often for pain-related stuff. But there is like a... some neurologists or people will give like 1,000 milligrams of ibuprofen.
Yeah.
To do like an abortive thing. But what is that? What does it mean, abortive? Like, you get an aura, and then how long do you have to take it before you may not be able to alter the course of the headache?
Like, in regards to when to take abortive therapy medications, every person is different. Like, people know their aura. People know when they're starting to have a migraine. So, like, for me, for example, I can tell my migraine is coming when, if I'm walking in with every step, I feel pain. I know that I'm going to start to get my migraine soon. So that's when I would normally take Advil in order to stop the pain. And it's, like you said, it's 800 milligrams or some crazy dose that is not normal for people to take. But for these headaches, you have to take a crazy dose to get rid of the pain.
I mean, I wouldn't say it's a crazy dose. It's only like another pill.
Yeah.
200, you know, 800 is usually the max dose at one time, but.
Yes, you're right. I always, like, when people see me taking 4 pills of 200 milligram ibuprofen, they all like freak out because they're like, wait, you're taking 4? We normally take 1 or 2 for like their other pains. But, you know, for someone with migraines, like, you have to take a higher dose, and that's just how it is.
I mean, and honestly, actually, most of the time, like for post-op pain and stuff, you know, for your and to your like broken bones and MSK type ailments, it's usually like 600 to 800 every 6 to 8 hours, not to exceed 2,400 milligrams in a day. and normally 801 dose. I mean, this stuff isn't going to be on the boards, but just for perspective.
Yeah.
So if you're out there having some sort of pain and you're only taking 200 or 400 of ibuprofen, this is not medical advice. It's only for educational purposes. But a person would probably do better to take 600 or 800.
Yeah.
So, just saying.
My doctor was actually the one who told me to take the 800 instead, because the 200, 400, 600 even wouldn't do much at all. So, and like Tylenol doesn't even work ever for me. But every patient's different. So you would take things like NSAIDs, like you said, aspirin, in order to just get rid of the headache if it's like an acute onset. But if you had like a really, really bad headache, you could take things like sumatriptan or ergotamine. Is that how it's pronounced? Or is it ergotamine or ergotamine?
I mean, like in medicine, I would say they're probably both acceptable pronunciations, but I can't think like what it would be appropriately. Like, it's probably more likely a short O, so it's probably more like ergotamine. But I don't know, I could be wrong. Write in if I'm totally wrong.
So ergotamine, sumatriptan, those could be given acutely as well. And sumatriptan is also kind of like prophylactic, but I personally never had it help me, but I don't know. So after sumatriptan, you could start with like prophylactic medication. So the first things that they normally tell us are lifestyle changes. So, you know, your diet is very important. If you have any triggers, or just eating healthy in general is very important. Following a regular sleeping pattern, avoiding any of the triggers that might cause your migraines. And then things like pharmacological things would include stuff like anticonvulsants. So we have like topiramate, beta blockers like propranolol, metoprolol, also the TCAs, amitriptyline, and calcium channel blockers. But then if you have chronic migraines, which I suffer from, you could take anti-CGRPs or CGRP monoclonal antibody medications. So that's, those are normally like injectables. The brand name I think is Emgality, for one of the medications. That's the one I take every month. It's like a subcutaneous shot you have to give to yourself.
Wow.
Yeah, it's very painful. And then like the last resort after you've tried everything else is Botox. So they put Botox injections in the forehead and parts of the head and the neck and also the shoulders, because sometimes that pain can radiate and cause migraines. So I got that done as well. That honestly seemed to help me the most personally. Like, instead of having headaches every day, I would have them every like third or fourth day. So that's if you have chronic migraines, that would be the treatment, the regimen that you would go with.
And so the indications for implementing a prophylactic medication, are there kind of hard and fast guidelines that, you know, might show up on the boards? Because I think for the acute treatment, you can probably take the progression that if it sounds like a headache without other factors that scream another cause that is like life-threatening or very serious, like a thunderclap, worst headache of my life sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So it's just garden variety, if you will, headache. On the test, first it's going to be acetaminophen or an NSAID. If that doesn't work for migraine, the next would be a triptan medication, sumatriptan, rizatriptan, whatever. Mm-hmm. And then the third line sort of headache thing treatments would be the ergotamine you mentioned, and then other fancy stuff that probably would not show up on an exam. But if you have like, is it like two migraines a week you need prophylaxis or what?
It's either two attacks per month that can cause disability for 3 or more days, or it could be 2 or more per week, regardless of the severity. And just having severe like disability regardless of the frequency at all. So those would be kind of like the indications of when you should start prophylactic therapy.
I would say too, like on an exam, they're not going to like do like
borderline, like,
yeah, like a person has 2 attacks per month, but it's like 48 hours each time. What they'll be wanting you to do is think clinically. And if somebody, they only describe one headache attack per month, but it's ongoing, and that person like can't work, that's probably enough to implement a prophylactic therapy. Because these, they're not, remember, really trying to test definitions. Sometimes it feels like that, but the distinction between 2 attacks per week, regardless of how bad they are, versus 2 attacks per month, but are super bad, you know, cause disability, they'll make it clear.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think I've ever seen like a really tricky migraine question that was, you know, very, very detailed. And it was never like borderline. It was very, very obvious that it was a migraine. And they always add something like an aura or nausea or vomiting or some huge giveaway to let people know that it's a migraine and not like a different type of headache. And they normally test on like the pharmacological like treatments.
Ooh. So I would say for board's purposes too, just, and these will be kind of random and also review. One of the ways they could set up questions related to headache or migraine specifically would be to present a vignette that is clearly a diagnosis of migraine, but also throw in some sort of past medical history that would be a contraindication, and then ask which of, you know, the following is the most appropriate treatment. So let's say a person has hypertension and you get like answer choices for treating this migraine are going to be sumatriptan or ergotamine, or I guess actually both those, that'd be a tough one because you don't want to give hypertensive patients either ergotamine or a triptan. So then you'd move on to like even third line things, but I'm not setting that up too well.
No, but exactly like you said, like if someone was hypertensive or like they had some sort of heart coronary artery disease, peripheral artery disease, or if they were pregnant, you wouldn't want to give a triptan. And same for like the ergotamines, like pregnancy, you can't give it. CADP, peripheral vascular disease, hypertension, like those are contraindicated. So for those, you would either try the lifestyle modifications or give a medication that wouldn't affect their current illness. And even like, for example, with if someone was hypotensive, you wouldn't want to start them with a beta blocker.
Yeah, good point. Yeah, you got to be on the lookout for stuff like that, because those are, you know, you can get so zero in on this being a test setting or whatnot. But like, yeah, if somebody's heart rate is 50, probably don't want to give them a beta blocker.
Exactly. So there's always like little things to look out for.
What about recommended best resource, or can you think of a standout sort of podcast, YouTube video, med ed like product that really explains or breaks down headaches well?
I'm using Amboss right now.
Okay.
To yeah. read about it. I also like, there's an article in the New England Journal of Medicine I mentioned earlier that broke down migraines really well. But if you want to like, if you want to compare the different types of headaches, I like using Amboss.
Okay. Well, I mean, there's a lot more students will be hearing from you. So I would say, you know, you can also email podcast at Inside the Boards if you'd like to join Mariah and do like a, I don't know, a study sort of group or sesh that we record. If you're good at teaching something particular, you know, reach out to us, give back. This is everyone's platform, not mine, certainly. So,
yes, and if you ever have a topic you would like us to talk about or that you would like to talk about, please let us know. That way we can cater to everyone's different needs,
yeah,
I guess.
Exactly, totally. All right. Well, Mariah, thank you. I guess we'll just end it there and look forward to hearing more from you throughout the next year and a half, maybe. You know, stick around for fourth year with us too.
Yeah, for sure. I would love to. So thank you so much for having me be a part of your team.
Absolutely. Yeah, we'll get more people to join you too.
Yes, for sure.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you.